The following programming is sponsored by Don Beischel. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Peasley Media Group. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you.
And welcome to the Conservative Voice once again. Thank you for joining us on this beautiful July 5th, 2024. Hope you had a wonderful July 4th. We are happy you joined us today for this special hour, where we have once again invited back someone we've interviewed in the past, and we want to hear a little more from today. And joining us in this next hour is Thomas Jefferson himself. Mr. Jefferson, thank you for joining the Conservative Voice.
Thank you, sir, and good day to you. And good day also to all of my fellow citizens who are in attendance at our colloquy today. If I had but 10 seconds to introduce myself to you, I would tell you that I am the author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and the father of the University of Virginia. Fortunately, we have decidedly more time than the fleeting tick-tock of your modern time-keeping devices and your other ephemeral modes of communication might otherwise allow. But thus it is that I shall spend the next half an hour or so here touching on various subjects that span the 83 years of my first visit here before I came back to visit again more recently in this admittedly strange and socially, if not geometrically, limiting context. This being as much of a true salon as our lamentable absence from Paris will allow, there will be copious opportunity, I believe, toward the end of my prepared remarks for us to engage in a more democratical exchange of ideas, asking of questions and that sort of thing. I confess to you that my own inclinations lean toward a conversation rather than a speech. But I visit you today in the role of a public servant. Thus, it is incumbent upon me to comport myself in a manner most conducive to your satisfaction upon the details of my life in public service. In spite of my reticence against speaking of personal matters in a public forum, changing circumstances call for a wider range of discussion than have been appropriate, perhaps, in my own day. Speaking of my day, I understand that the imaginative distance you will have to travel in order to engage in my subject matter is quite vast. I will therefore begin by asking all of you to undertake a temporal journey of much less formidable span. I will begin with this question then. Call to your minds, if you will, your first memory. If you cannot remember that, skip that. Go on to the next one. Now, do you have it in mind? Do not worry. I will not ask you to share. That is my burden today, not yours. But do keep it in mind. We may have recourse to those memories later, depending on where our discussion leads us. Now, I will share with you my earliest memory. My very first memory is from when I was 2 years old. My family was moving from Shadwell, the home that my father built in Albemarle County, Virginia. My father's name was Peter Jefferson. We were moving from that home to Tuckahoe Plantation, located eastward in Goochland County, where we would live from 1746 to 1751. What I remember of the experience was being carried on a pillow on horseback by a slave. That is how I wrote about it in what you would call my autobiography. 2 years before I was born upon that pillow by a slave, I was born into a world where slavery was normal, at least to those of us who were born in such privileged circumstances. As I grew up in Virginia, I came to know as normal many other things that you, from your lofty peak atop posterity, might consider to be strange indeed. Virginia, being part of the British Empire, I was taught to be proud of the fact that I was a subject of a king, not elected by the free voice of the people. As I grew and attended William and Mary College, I came to understand that I would be able to vote upon the attainment of my majority, that being 21 years of age, but that other Virginians would not be able to do so at any age if they never owned property. It was perfectly normal, of course, that no woman would be able to vote, no matter how much property she might own. Slaves, of course, could not own property, much less vote. Even within the ownership of property, I came to know restrictions that were ancient and, I began to think, counterproductive, yet still in place. A word that might not have a lot of meaning to you, primogeniture. And another one, entail. They may very well be terms with which only your professors in your universities or your local historians and perhaps a few of your perspicacious young scholars are familiar. But they dominated the landscape of my youth and my young adulthood. Primogeniture was the right of the firstborn son to inherit the parent's entire estate. Entail was the legal institution that enforced it. Together, they meant that ever-increasing amounts of land and property would be tied up in the possession of ever-decreasing numbers of extremely wealthy and powerful families who had no other virtue to argue for their growing power but their name. And perhaps a coat of arms, which I am told may be purchased as easily as any other coat. I looked it up once when I was trying to impress a young lady. It's a long story. Where was I? Ah, yes. Do not be ashamed if these terms, primogeniture and entail, are unfamiliar to you. If they seem to be obscure relics of a past that no longer has any practical application in your day or in your day-to-day lives, I will consider at least one of the efforts of my own life to have been successful. I led the legal battle to rid Virginia of primogeniture and entail, and it was a bitter fight indeed. The Virginia into which I was born allowed one religion. This is another concept that may seem like a distant and dusty past to you. Well, perhaps that is not a precise way to put it, though. It would be closer to the truth to say that the Virginia in which I was born allowed one sect, the Anglican Church, the Church of England. Even other sects of Christianity were legally forbidden. And as for public education, well, there simply was none in Virginia. I began my education under Reverend William Douglas at the schoolhouse on Tuckahoe Plantation, which I mentioned before. I continued it in the Latin school of Reverend James Morey, followed by the before-mentioned William and Mary College. The point is that the advantages I gained from a solid education were available to me because of my family name and relative wealth. Yes, I studied hard and applied myself far more than the average student. But if there were any young Benjamin Franklins or Roger Shermans among the poor of the 18th century Virginia, our perfect lack of any decent public education system meant that we would never find them, or at least the chances were close to zero. They also meant that the public would never benefit from their undiscovered and uncultivated genius. I later made a study of it and found that upwards of 50% of the men in Virginia never learned how to read or write well enough to sign their own names. The percentage for the ladies, as of about 1776, was even higher. Every one of those situations that I have now described was considered normal, and I was brought up to consider them as being so. Eventually, I came to see most of these situations as requiring change within my lifetime. My degree of success at effecting that change varied widely over the years. many of you in attendance to our conversation today may be students of one kind or another. And there may be some who are at college or university or even younger than that. Well, to those of you, I say, when I was your age, I thought I was going to change the world. And I did, but not as much as I at first thought I was going to do. As to ridding ourselves of monarchy, well, most of you are already familiar with much of that story. For me, it began during my law school days while I was studying under the mentorship of George Wythe. In 1765, I was not an important enough figure in Williamsburg to be in the room where the House of Burgesses debates happened. But I was eager enough to know that I wanted to be there, at least someday. So I listened at the door. It was at the end of May in that particular year that I listened through that door as Patrick Henry, defending his resolutions against the Stamp Act, decried our irresponsible king for violating the rights of the people. It was his duty, that means the king's duty, to protect. There perhaps are many young students who would wish that their college years would pass without tumult, without world-changing events to interrupt the progress of their learning, and perhaps their enjoyment as well of a rite of passage that is well established in their community. Alas, I was not one of those students. The nexus of study and of civil upheaval in that short mile that connected the college, the governor's palace, and the capital of Virginia at the time, with Mr. Wythe's home tucked neatly in the middle, gave me a practical and theoretical school not to be outdone for one who, like me, wanted to change the world. After the Stamp Act crisis, there followed nearly a decade of relative quietude in which I was able to pursue what had every appearance of blossoming into a typical Virginia planter's life. I completed my law studies and began my legal career. I married Martha Wales Skelton, and we began a family at the home I was building on a mountaintop that my father had purchased many years before, one which I named Monticello. When my father-in-law, John Wales, passed away in 1774, my property in both land and slaves increased dramatically. Because of the toil of my father and the family name of my mother, Jane Randolph, I had been born into the landed gentry. But this was something loftier still. Even while my life appeared on the surface to be moving along apace with a trajectory one might expect from a Virginia planter, I was planting the seeds for what would soon blossom from a set of regional rebellions to a full-grown revolution that would change all my expectations. I beg your forgiveness, as our limited time together requires me to fly swiftly past the events that are worthy of our attention. I find that it is easier to lose my sense of time these days. After you pass 200 years of age or so, the decades are difficult enough to organize in one's mind, and the minutes and the hours, they simply fly by. But by 1775, I had left my law practice and devoted myself to public service. Although I was still a relatively junior member of what, by this point, was the House of Burgesses, I had begun to establish my reputation as a draftsman and as someone who could be counted upon to do the hard work behind the scenes, away from the grand speeches and popular flourishes. These qualities combined with the tumbling forward of events to bring me to Philadelphia and to the Congress being held there in the summer of 1775, where I quickly was assigned to numerous writing duties. By the spring of 1776, the uneven progress toward revolution had escalated to battle lines being clearly drawn both on battlefields and in assembly halls throughout the colonies. When I returned to Philadelphia in May of that year, the Continental Congress had already taken public steps, with John Adams at the very vocal lead, to encourage the colonies to ready themselves for independence by organizing their own governments and military forces. When I was assigned to the committee to write the Declaration of Independence, it was simply yet another committee on which I would be delegated much, if not all, of the initial writing responsibilities. None of us had any idea as to the importance that document would eventually gain in the American mind. If we had known how famous it, and by connection its primary draftsman, would eventually become, I am tempted to say that John Adams would have been more eager to have written it himself. But that would be an unkindness toward a man I have grown to respect as a friend and as a colleague. It wouldn't have been the last time that Mr. Adams would have willingly stepped aside and facilitated another's glory, because he knew that he was not the person best suited for the job. Mr. Adams never lost sight of the greater cause. I worked alone for just over a fortnight on my draft. The committee made a few changes and submitted it to Congress, who in turn did what they always do to such things. I was in no way happy with the final version of the document at the time. But even in my personal discomfiture, I knew that it wasn't about me. It was about the cause. An irony about the ideals for which we were fighting is that although personal liberty is among the central rights for which we effected our revolution, we knew that it could never be won and that it can never be truly enjoyed if Americans refuse to balance their own personal liberty with the sacrifices called for by our duty to others. Of liberty, then, I would say that in the whole plenitude of its extent, it is unobstructed action according to our will, but rightful liberty is unobstructed action according to our will within the limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others. We, of course, did not achieve the plenitude of that rightful liberty in 1776, nor any time in my later life. But we made a choice to work toward that goal when we voted to make the words of the Declaration of Independence centered on that ancient phrase, all men are created equal, speak for the ideals of our revolution. When I returned to Virginia at the end of that summer, I got right to work on two more of the problems that I listed earlier, religious freedom and public education. I spent the next 3 years working in the Virginia legislature, undertaking a massive effort to update all of the ancient laws of Virginia. That effort produced one of my greatest successes, the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom. It took until 1786 that act would become law in Virginia. And it never would have succeeded without the determination and legislative leadership of James Madison. That effort and that law laid the groundwork for Mr. Madison's work on the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. In that way, my efforts served as a direct precedent for the establishment of our constitutional wall of separation between church and state. My 3 years in Virginia legislature also served as the starting point for my lifelong effort to solve the problem of public education in Virginia. I never fully succeeded. The idea behind public education is that those with means help those without gain access to education equal to their abilities, not to their family name or wealth. The argument against funding public education seems always to be the same. Those who have do not wish to help those who have not. The system that I proposed in 1779 was perhaps by your standards very modest, but it was still too far-reaching for my fellow Virginians. In my plan, what eventually became the University of Virginia was meant to be the pinnacle of a tiered system that would systematically find those of genius who would otherwise languish in obscurity due to their poverty. The state likewise languishing for want of great leaders who otherwise rise from poverty only by occasional luck and circumstance. Instead, it took me until the very last year of my life to establish only the university itself on the liberal grounds that I had originally intended. I meant that this institution would be based on the illimitable freedom of the human mind. I established it to be a place where we are not afraid to follow truth wherever it may lead, nor to tolerate any error so long as reason is left free to combat it. I look to it as a germ from which a great tree will spread itself. My legislative career ended when I was elected as governor of Virginia. During my two consecutive one-year terms, I faced challenges and learned harsh lessons that could never have been part of my experience in other branches of government. I had the misfortune to preside over the state during the fateful raid early in 1781, led by the parricide Benedict Arnold. Matters continued to get worse, reaching a nadir not only for the war in Virginia, but also for my political career, when British troops occupied Charlottesville. And, as it turned out, Monticello. I narrowly escaped capture. Later, I narrowly avoided a politically motivated censure by the Virginia legislature. These events were soon followed by a tragedy beyond my capacity to speak of in more detail, or at least not in great detail, even now, even so long afterward. During the autumn of the year following our great victory at Yorktown, my dear wife, Martha, passed away from a combination of long-term ill health and complications of childbirth. In every scheme of my happiness, she was placed in the foreground of the picture as the principal figure. With that taken away, it was no picture for me. Between the failure of my governorship and this personal loss, I decided that I was finished with public life. At nearly 40 years of age, I believed that my work in politics was over. It took the combined efforts of a number of my friends and colleagues, not the least of which being James Madison, to convince me to emerge from that dark place and return to my calling. By 1783, I was serving in the Congress of the Confederacy, and by August of the next year, I was on my way to France for what turned into a five-year term as United States representative in Europe, with Paris as my new temporary home. I do hope that none of you ever have to start over as I did. But if you do, may I suggest that you will find no better place to begin life anew than Paris. When I returned to the United States in 1789, I was a new man with new ideas to strengthen my old principles. And it was a good thing that I was thus refreshed. But what I found when I began my service as the first United States Secretary of State in New York City, the temporary capital of the new United States, shocked and disappointed me. A counter-revolution had begun, with a push to instate monarchical and aristocratical ideas in our nascent republic. Although at first I did not realize that my own friend John Adams had begun to express ideas that supported a new aristocracy here. As for the insidious push toward monarchy, well, that was led by none other than Alexander Hamilton. My differences with Alexander Hamilton tended to spring from the 10th Amendment. I gave it a high value. He didn't think that it meant anything. My differences with John Adams tended to spring from our differing view of human nature. I believe that people are fundamentally good and only need the tools and the opportunity to do good. Hence, the role of government is to facilitate those opportunities and then get out of the way. Mr. Adams has ever held a much more pessimistic view of human nature than ever I did. He believed that the common man was not yet ripe for as much self-government as I believe, if indeed they ever would be ready. We both agreed that education was the only means by which this worthiness to hold the reins of their own government responsibility could be achieved. I cannot say that my differences with Mr. Hamilton led to a breach, because we worked together only briefly in early 1790 before I understood the full extent of his plans. Unfortunately, such a breadth of differences did cause a terrible breach between myself and my friend, Mr. Adams. He and I stood opposed to one another as candidates in the election of 1796. There being no 12th Amendment yet, the result was that the man with the highest number of Electoral College votes became president. That was Mr. Adams, because there was a majority. And the man with the second most became vice president, myself. But his choices as president led the country not only closer to something very unlike the America I envisioned in 1776, but also to an America in which those in power could ignore the limits of the Constitution, seemingly without repercussion. Though I never doubted Mr. Adams' character or honesty, I came to believe that he was in grave error and that I had to oppose him. That opposition resulted in my being elected President of the United States in the second election in which Mr. Adams and I stood opposed to one another. Mr. Adams garnered the third highest number of Electoral College votes, and I tied with Aaron Burr. What resulted was not only a terrible rift in the friendship between Mr. Adams and myself, but also a terrible rift in the nation. A combination of Aaron Burr's ambition and corruption and the Federalists holding party above country caused a constitutional crisis that saw us teetering on the edge of civil war. Fortunately, enough Federalists chose to stand tall and put their duty to their country above their personal desires, and the nation survived. My election as president represented the first transfer of power from one political party to another under the Constitution. The fact that we navigated it peacefully, without bloodshed, was a credit also to John Adams. If he had resisted, if he had denied the validity of the election and had chosen to attempt to hold on to office that the voice of the people had taken from him, our nation was too young and frail to have withstood the challenge. One of Mr. Adams's greatest deeds was the same as the two that stand as George Washington's greatest. He walked away from power willingly. I presided over a divided nation as president, and I sought to unify the country while steering a course dictated by the choice of the American people to change both the executive as well as the legislative branches in our government. During my first term, I was tested by the greatest opportunity of my entire presidency, the Louisiana Purchase. With my decision to take a constitutional risk and rely on the judgment of the American people to decide if I had done their will, I swallowed my pride and stepped outside of the strict construction that I personally believed could have forbidden the action. In the end, the people exercised their judgment with approval of my action. But they did not have to do so. If they had condemned my action by voting me out of office, I would have accepted their judgment all the same. The precedent here with the Louisiana Purchase is not he who wins is right, but rather he who accepts the voice of the majority is right. The will of the majority, the natural law of every society, is the only sure guardian of the rights of man. During my second term, I was tested by the warring nations of England and France. They were attempting to draw the U.S. onto their respective sides in their conflict with each other. In my efforts to steer a course of independent neutrality, I may have erred, but it was an error of the head, not of the heart. The embargo that I used as an experiment in economic warfare resulted in increased manufactures in the United States, making us more independent, but it was a disaster for those states that depended on commerce with foreign nations. At the end of 8 years as president, I had reduced the national debt by over 25%, even with the sizable bill for the Louisiana Purchase taken into account. The final judgment on my tenure was given by the people when they elected the man who was my preference to succeed me, James Madison. I do not envy him the trial that he faced as president. As for me, never did a prisoner released from his chains feel such relief as I did on shaking off the shackles of power. In a career of 40 years public service, I helped to mitigate a number of the societal problems that had been considered normal and not even as problems, maybe even beneficial in some cases to society when I was a young man. Others of those evils I failed to reduce with any efficacy. My ability to change the world ended when I left it for the first time. This afternoon's visit, therefore, allows me only the opportunity to tell you of what I did and what I did not. It is my hope that my story and the rest of our conversation today will inspire you in some way to change the things that may have been seen as normal at the time of your birth, but which you now understand to be harmful. And having said all that, as a self-testimonial, I suppose, of my own life, what I would like to do is one of my favorite things, that is, close my mouth, and then turn the floor to my hosts for such questions as they may wish to put to me for a little while.
Wow, that was a fascinating discussion, and you know, when you come back to something as fundamentally critical as the drafting of the Declaration of Independence, and you were selected as the person to write that document, how long did it take, and how did you come up with that language?
My portion of the drafting process of the Declaration of Independence, it took approximately 2.5 weeks. I sat down to write my first draft the first night I was given the assignment, if you may call it that, and that was June 11th, 1776. I had received the most votes in Congress for the members of that committee. There were 5 members. I was the only Southerner as a member of the committee. I did not keep my first draft, did not store it anywhere safely. I now wonder, perhaps it may have been useful for those in your day to have kept that. I worked on it alone then. On and off for 2.5 weeks, I was on a few dozen other committees. I submitted it to other members of the committee, specifically John Adams and Benjamin Franklin. I sent it to Dr. Franklin. He was not actually able to, nor would it have been appropriate for him to have come to me at my quarters at the corner of 7th and Market Street. He was so much senior delegate, it was appropriate for me to go to him and ask for his commentary. Each of them made their own relatively, I think, minor suggestions for changes. Some were more than minor. I then spent, that was the 28th. I then spent the weekend writing up a fair copy that Congress could, part of the weekend I wrote it up on that weekend, and then submitted to Congress over the weekend so it could just sit on the table and members of Congress could read it at their leisure. We then spent the day of the 1st and into the 2nd debating independence. So that is to say, the resolution for independency that Richard Henry Lee had proposed on June 7th, which is a separate document and separate legal entity from the Declaration of Independence. We debated the resolution for independence on July 1st and 2nd, voted for independence on the 2nd. Then, the way I recalled it later when I wrote about it was in the afternoon of the 2nd and all day on the 3rd, we debated and made alterations to the contents of the announcement of that independence upon which we had decided on the 2nd. Now, later on, there was some discrepancy in the way John Adams and I wrote about it as older men. I confess to you, even now, I cannot remember things if I didn't write them down. But I was only writing, we were both writing from memory at the time, in our 8th decade of life. I recalled us as having debated it in the morning of the 4th, but if you look at the records of Congress, you can see that the morning of the 4th, we didn't actually do any debating of the contents of the Declaration. And it wasn't considered to be that important of a day. I went shopping that morning. I bought some gloves for my wife. I bought a new thermometer, which I used for many years thereafter, because this was a formality. It was an important part of a legal process that is not necessarily written down, but one of tradition that was rooted in the British Constitution, which is, of course, more rooted in tradition than in any written process. It was on the afternoon of July 4th that we voted for this announcement and the final wording of our description or our explanation of what we meant by the independence that we had voted on July 2nd.
Interesting. When you were president, I mean, it is astonishing to think of being sort of, the third president in this brand new republic, this brand new country that had been formed out of this war and bloodshed. And yet this country had to get moving and be formed up. And you were part of doing that. You become the third president. And what is in your view, your most important achievement as president?
I spoke a bit about it during my prepared remarks in the first half of our hour together here today, but I'll say it more explicitly now. I believe that having presided over this first delicate and dangerous transition between these two emerging political parties successfully is something I believe would stand as my greatest legacy for my presidency. And when I say successfully, I mean peacefully. In my inaugural address, I emphasized the rights of the minority, meaning the Federalist Party in this case, and that they must always be respected by those who are in power, the majority. I also emphasized the fact that the majority is the rightful ruler of a nation under the kind of constitution we have. Obviously, that is a more complex thing than simply saying majority rules. Even in Athenian Athens, it was not simple majority. In the Roman Republic, in their early version of what we used as one of our models, they did not have truly a majority rule either within their representative government, nor do we have it here. But I sought to balance the fact that we haven't found anything better yet as of 1800 than majority rule, with the fact that we also cannot deny the fact that 174 despots or 1 million despots, that kind of a circumstance is not superior to one despot, one tyrant. I, by emphasizing the peaceful transfer, by emphasizing a kind of conversation between these parties that were emerging, by trying to steer a course that respected those who disagreed with me as long as they did not make it clear they wanted to stop all functioning government whatsoever if they didn't get their way, I think I did successfully steer the bark of our state through seas that have destroyed other governments by the people, including one that was falling into failure at the very same time in France. And that is my proudest achievement as president.
You touched on something very, very important to, I think, many Americans. There is a constant debate in this nation as to whether this is a democracy or some other form of government. What is the form of our government?
It is, as of at least 1826, the least I can discuss, unique. Athens was a democracy, but it was very limited. The people who could vote, we say every citizen shows up directly and can speak directly in a democracy. In the Athenian democracy, everyone who is considered to be a citizen, which means even an even more limited group than I listed early when talking about Virginia and those who could vote, when the question was asked at the beginning of the meeting, who wishes to speak, anyone who was allowed to attend could speak. and a citizen. And that is impossible in a large situation. And it was even limited in Athens. The Roman Republic is more of a model for our form of government. And it was very complicated, even convoluted. It was not a pure republic. It was an amalgamation of traditions that were added on to each other because of the Romans' concept that they wouldn't have referred to it as their government as their constitution, but more as the will and the wishes of our ancestors, which is something antithetical to my own beliefs regarding the rights of humankind and the functioning of government. So we don't have either one of those things. It's certainly not a pure democracy. But I don't think that if anyone seriously studies our Constitution, there's no serious discussion as to whether or not it's a democracy. I think, I often would refer to it as a democracy, but I do not mean an Athenian democracy, a pure democracy. What I mean is that when Montesquieu was writing in the 1750s about forms of government, and when Cicero, two millennia previously, was writing about the forms of government, each of them broke down the three basic forms of government as they saw it, and they broke them down the same way, separated by two millennia. And Montesquieu is the most quoted constitutional law reference of all those who debated our Constitution, debated the Federalist Papers, created our government. What were the three forms of government they referred to? They referred to monarchy as being one kind, aristocracy as the other kind, and democracy as then the third kind. That is how they broke it down. Now, I assure you, Montesquieu was not foolish or simplistic enough to believe that there were any pure democracies in the world in the 1750s. But yet he utilized that as a category. So we have the same word being used in two different ways. I believe, therefore, if you get into a debate as to whether or not America is a democracy, I suspect it's because people are diving into the specifics of, well, some may be using one of the usages of that term, democracy, and some the other. Those who say America is not a democracy might be scholars of the Athenian democracy. And if you look at that, you say, well, we're not that, obviously. But those who are saying, well, America is a democracy, they may be scholars of Montesquieu and of Cicero. And in that context, America is a democracy because it is not an aristocracy and it is not a monarchy. So I suspect the debate you're talking to may be suffering from that confusion of, I think you have to agree on terms before you can have a productive conversation or productive debate. And I suspect those who debate that are not first agreeing on terms.
I think you are exactly correct. There is a cohort of Americans today who believe that this is a pure democracy where the majority should simply rule. The tyranny of the mob should be our governance. And obviously, the founders were smart enough to make sure that that wasn't what we had, that in fact, to the point you made a moment ago, we were designed in a way that the rights of the minority would be respected, and despite being possibly out of power, they would have the protections of the Constitution, which protected their rights. And I think that's lost among some Americans today who simply want to see their policies implemented without restriction. It's fascinating. One thing that I don't know if anyone's really talked about much is this war with the Barbary pirates that you were engaged in. I mean, we kind of forget that happened in this country, I think. So tell me, how did that start and what happened?
Now, it dragged over about 3 years from my first term into my second term of my presidency, more than 3 years. The Pasha of Tripoli, Yusuf Karamanli, had overthrown his brother and in a forceful overthrow of government based on no legalities, even within the legalities of the various states of Northern Africa. And each of them for time immemorial had been demanding, each of these Barbary states had been demanding ransom from all of the civilized world to prevent their shipping from their piratical ships from attacking our trading vessels. I had come to grips with this while I was representing the United States in Europe with Mr. Adams. We had tried to negotiate to bring European nations to come together to form an international navy. Wouldn't have taken much. Each of these, Tunis and Tripoli, et cetera, along the northern coast of Africa. Each of them had very weak, not even, you couldn't even recall them navies, but left unchecked when they were powerful enough to enforce their lawless acts. I wasn't able to succeed even getting the United States to want to contribute a boat to that, and so we continued to pay tribute to these states. I finally, as president, when Youssef Karamanli demanded, because there was a new president of the United States, that we should give him more gifts, as he called them, but it was more tribute, more bribe money. I said no, and he declared war as he cut down the flagpole in front of the United States Embassy in Tripoli. We sent a frigate. It ran aground on some shoals. It was captured. We then sent our Navy as well as United States Marines to free our men who had been taken prisoner from the frigate, and we succeeded. They succeeded in threatening Pasha Karamanli enough to get him to free our men. Stephen Decatur, who had led a mission to destroy the frigate and keep it from being, because it was captured by the Tripolitans, and we wanted to prevent the embarrassment and disgrace of having a United States ship of war being used by an enemy nation. And his act of bravery was certainly, I think, the greatest of the age, and established our tradition of bravery. Began one of the earliest establishments of our traditions of bravery in the United States Navy, whereas the first deployment of United States Marines on foreign soil occurred during this, on our part, undeclared war, where United States Marines were deployed actually in Egypt and marched across Egypt and the deserts, bringing together various tribes and peoples from northern Africa in a brief coalition to fight against Pasha Karamanli, in order enough to free our men and to begin a process of what eventually would end well over a decade later, cause the end of having to pay all of this tribute to these northern Africa piratical states.
It is a fascinating history. When you look at the full scope of your career, the number of roles that you played and the accomplishments that you achieved within those roles are astonishing. What in all of that do you see as your greatest failure? What went wrong in your efforts?
Greatest failure. I will focus on my greatest public failure, because that is, I think, the reason why we're here today, my public service.
Yes.
I was saying that I at one point made a somewhat bitter comment that my greatest mistake was cooperating with Alexander Hamilton with the movement to the placement of the permanent capital of the United States and the assumption of the state debts. However, that was in a moment of weakness and bitterness. I do not think that is the case. My successes in the places that can be called successes resulted from my listening to and paying attention to the information presented to me in the moment by experts and by those who I trusted, who were authorities, and adapting from what my assumptions had been to what the realities were at the time. My greatest failures, for instance, the Embargo Act of my presidency. Another one, though it's difficult to say which was a greater failure, my failure to defend, rally the people of Virginia and defend Virginia against the multiple invasions of Virginia during my governorship. In these circumstances, those two stand out. I failed because I either was too blind or too stubborn. I did not listen to the experts around me and adapt to the new situation, in some cases that were unprecedented. Sometimes I adhered too closely to rules that I believed that I'd fought for maybe even a decade or more earlier. Sometimes I applied ideas that had worked 4 decades and 3 decades earlier, as with the Embargo Act, that no longer applied. So I would say these two things, my failure as governor to defend Virginia and the Embargo Act, but the greatest failure, I think, can be summarized as one thing between the two of them, which in these circumstances, and there were others in my life, my failure was based on refusing to do something that I hold as one of the highest goals of humanity, which is to throw away those things that don't work anymore. It is to refuse to hold on to traditions just because they're traditions, or the ways of your ancestors just because they are the ways of your ancestors, be they superstitions or be they a proven successful experiments and practical application in government. I think it is irrelevant. To blindly hold on to something that may have worked before just because it has worked before, not be open to new solutions, even those new solutions which may seem to go against what your personal beliefs or philosophy or principles are is to invite failures. And there were a few times when I failed in that way, including the two that I mentioned to you. I'm not sure.
No, I had a challenge there, hearing parts of that. As we come to the last few moments of this discussion, what would you like to share with us?
Well, I would like to introduce you to my 21st century guide, Stephen Edenbow, and maybe he can make a few comments as I am being called to a meeting with John Adams. And if you think that John Adams is curmudgeonly when you are on time, you have no idea how testy he can be if you are tardy. So if you'll excuse me, I will make my way out and invite in Mr. Edenbow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Jefferson. Appreciate your time this afternoon. And Steve, it's nice to speak with you.
Gary, it is a pleasure to speak with you as well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I so enjoy these discussions. And
thank you.
And if you could just, you know, we've got a couple of moments left. If you could just tell us a little bit about how you came to this situation where you do this and you do it so well that it is really like stepping back in history.
Thank you. I'll try to drop the accent as I talk here. Sometimes I feel like I have to chew some gum or something to get my jaw working a different way after I've taken on that accent for a while. I came to Philadelphia and I was pursuing just regular acting. I didn't know this kind of thing existed to this level of scholarship. I'd seen people in, you know, wigs and costumes and parades, but nothing more involved before that. And folks who had founded the American Historical Theater, Bill and Pam Summerfield, and then the one person that was working in the office at the time, Kim Hanley, they saw me doing unrelated acting work, and they approached me and they said, well, we need a Thomas Jefferson. And you look like Thomas Jefferson. And I said, I do. They said, you do. And they gave me my first, this was 1999, they gave me my first books, my first costume, my first appearance was in Independence National Historical Park. And I just fell in love with the combination of scholarship and writing and acting and travel and just all the things that come together to make this unique undertaking what it is. And well, that was 1999, and I've built a clientele since then. Well, there was a bit of a bumpy time there during the pandemic, but now things are building back. And it's what gets me up in the morning. It's often what wakes me up in the middle of the night. And it's my driving purpose in life.
Well, it's a fascinating thing for us to be able to look through you, you know, through your presentation into the life of this great man and better understand it. And I think it's so much more accessible than if you simply are looking at a website with a photograph. This is just delightful.
Thank you.
So you must have spent over these years then a lot of time really digging in and understanding the history. This isn't something you're just doing flippantly.
I approach it like a job. This is not a hobby. This is not my free time. This is not, you know, something I do for fun. I respect hobbies a great deal, and I have them, and I've worked hard to make sure that I have them. Otherwise, you do this for too long, and you can lose perspective. But I do approach it like work, and so the sort of cliche 10,000 hours is something that I've certainly put in, and more than that over the last, going on 25 years now. The reading, the learning is constant. The last number of years now, I've been diving a lot more into the Roman Republic specifically, not the Roman Empire after that, but the Roman Republic and the Athenian democracy and how they fell, and the French Republic and how it fell, and looking at parallels and trying to draw pictures for Americans that can be useful now. But yeah, the research and all that, it's just constant.
That's fantastic. And I think that reference back to the Roman Republic is really helpful to help understand this in a historical context. It's just extremely helpful. Let me ask you, how do people get a hold of you if they would like to have you come and do a show for them?
Well, I've got two websites I'll mention. One, my own personal one. It's Your Thomas Jefferson. So possessive, like belongs to you. He's America's. He's yours. YourThomasJefferson.com, all one word. And then with American Historical Theater, if you go to their website, it's got a very wide array of historical figures. And I'm on there as Jefferson. I'm on the board of directors of American Historical Theater. So if you come to me, you know, it's whichever one you go to, I'm happy to connect you with American Historical Theater. But American Historical Theater it's spelled the British way, which is a little ironic. But one of the founders, Pam Summerfield, was born in England, and she holds no hard feelings regarding the Declaration of Independence. Or she held none. She's since passed away. But American Historical Theater's website is AH Theater, and that's spelled the British way with the T and the R and the E mixed up the way the Brits seem to think they know theater or something. So ahtheater.org, ahtheater.org, and yourthomasjefferson.com. Those are the two websites that will put you in my direction and into a vast array of other resources with what I do and my colleagues do.
Well, we appreciate you doing it with us this afternoon, following the 4th of July, now the 5th of July, and we're in the midst of yet another celebration of America's founding. And I just appreciate the time you spent with us and look forward to having you at an event again in the future. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Have a good day.